Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And if you are wondering where your Edward Snowden is at this hour, I don't know if we're going to be able to help you. The NSA leaker is either in the air, in Moscow, in Cuba, in Venezuela, or in Ecuador, or anywhere else in the world except Hong Kong. That we know. He left there over the weekend after being encouraged to go by Chinese authorities, according to some reports, and told that no one would stop him by Hong Kong authorities, according to some other reports. None of this is making the Obama administration feel very good about the issue of who's the next leaker. Later this hour, an initiative that suggests the administration might be worried it could come from the Peace Corps or the Social Security Administration. But we begin with a curious day for the U.S. Supreme Court. With so much before it, once again, the court has held off on issuing two expected decisions on gay marriage and one on voting rights. It seems to have avoided altogether a big decision in the affirmative action case, Fisher versus the University of Texas. Joining us now to talk about this, Kareem Creighton, professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What exactly happened in the Fisher case here? It was bumped back to the Fifth Circuit. Why and how unusual is that?
Well, sometimes the court decides that a case that has already gone through the briefing and the argument was maybe not properly heard in the first place so that it could be sent back for further proceedings. And that's what happened here. By a vote of 7-1, the court basically said, we don't think that the circuit court, the court below, did all of the findings that it could have done or perhaps should have done under the rules to determine whether or not the affirmative action policy at the University of Texas sort of complied with the rules that they stated in a previous case called Grutter. And so they've sent the case back for further proceedings to make that clear.
Now, I'm no law student and I'm no judge, but I am part of, you know, the jury of Americans here. Wouldn't that be the kind of thing they would have suggested at the beginning when they decided to take the case from the Fifth Circuit? Wouldn't they have made that clear then? Isn't that exactly the kind of thing that they would have ruled on when they issued the writ that they're actually going to consider the case?
It's a fair point. I think many times when the court gets a case, at this stage, everything has been litigated and most of the procedural matters have been dealt with. But it could be that the issue wasn't necessarily as clear to all of the justices until the arguments were made in front of it. And so, you know, one way of reading this is that, you know, a judge or a series of justices now agree that more time needs to be had, more evidence needs to be presented to the lower court in order to come up with the best factual analysis of whether or not the case actually, again, survives the rule that the court set up in Grutter. Of course, the other answer to this could be an opinion was written and a number of judges just couldn't all agree. And so the only thing they could agree about was to send it back.
All right. So if you're in a university administrator and you're watching this very, very closely, what do you take from this? What do you think is going to happen in the Fifth Circuit? How will this get sharpened to the point where maybe the court would make a decision that would have implications for higher education?
That's a very good point. I think, frankly, if you're a university administrator, you're probably pulling your hair out and looking at every word and every sentence to try and gain some clue about what the Supreme Court is looking for. So on the one hand, they've sent this case back suggesting that the effort to overturn the Texas policy was not enough. It wasn't strong enough to win the day. On the other hand, there are people, I'm sure, who attacked this policy who say, well, it seems that some justices, Justice Scalia being one of them, is only bothered by the fact that there was no frontal attack on the rule that the court set forth in Grutter, which says that maybe diversity isn't the best, strongest, compelling rationale for having an affirmative action plan. So both sides will go back to the drawing board trying to pull as many clues from this case as possible, I think.
Well, affirmative action, of course, a big issue in American life, but the small arcane details there in this decision that's going back to the Fifth Circuit, perhaps the court has a bigger appetite for some bigger constitutional questions. And we have a couple of indications. A case on sex offenders really involves the question of ex post facto, whether the court can impose something on individuals who were adjudicated before a law was passed, if a law applies to people who had something happen to them before the law was passed. Can you explain the sex offenders case to us briefly?
Sure. Essentially, the person whose rights are at issue had been convicted of an offense that was later listed among those sorts of criminal acts that are subject to registration rules. That's the Offender Act that's being challenged here. And the court said basically that even though this person had served their time prior to the time that this congressional statute was adopted, the person was still subject to its rules. And while some people might have argued, as he did, that this is sort of after-the-fact application, the court in a lot of ways seemed to believe that, well, he was still under some sort of supervision, and therefore it wasn't sort of it wasn't the same kind of rule where you look back and try to bring people into a class of people that you regulate. Rather, he was always among the people that were still under federal supervision. In that case, he still had to do some compliance requirements, and they said that the new rule should apply to him. And Chief Justice Roberts, just to add one small point, said that, well, you know, this might not necessarily be justified under the police power, as in passing criminal law, but it could be justified under the necessary and proper clause, suggesting that things necessary to carry out a goal that Congress announces are still within its constitutional power to accomplish.
And the court also announced today that they are going to take up the question of the recessed appointments at the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, which is another separation of powers question. Can recess appointments supersede Senate advice and consent requirements under the Constitution? We'll know about that in the next term. Generally speaking, do you think the court is weary of its 5-4 narrow split, doesn't really want to issue these kinds of narrow decisions, and is maybe having some trouble with these big cases?
Well, I think at least some people on the court, probably the Chief Justice, since he's among the newer members and is likely to be there for some time, is definitely concerned about the credibility of the court to make decisions, as he says, in ways that call balls and strikes as opposed to playing politics. And so I think they're going to be very concerned in the next, you know, few terms, certainly as this one closes, to make sure that they are appearing to the public as though they're making decisions based on rules and not on wants and desires. And so questions like the health care decision last term, certainly the voting rights decision coming up in the next few days, and as you point out, the recess appointment issue will be important not just for the outcome, who wins and who loses, but I think the level of rationale and justification that's present in what the court decides. So the 5-4 decisions, I think, are going to be tests of that credibility. But I think regardless of whether it's 5-4 or 6-3 or more, the test really is going to come in the level of justification that's evident in the writings that support the opinions the court issues.
Well, what we're seeing in this term is the credibility of the Roberts Court on trial in a certain extent, avoiding a decision on affirmative action. And we'll see what happens with the other cases. Kareem Creighton, professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All of this non-decisioning by the Supremes there at the Supreme Court has made for something of a letdown on the steps of the Capitol, where many, many people have been waiting for the outcome of this historic court term. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, spent a little time on the steps of the Supreme Court. What was the feeling?
Not with a bang, but a whimper, John. That's how the day ended. It was hot out, as it often is during these summer decision days. Everybody's remembering back to health care last year when it was a sweaty, horrible, soggy day in Washington, and this was no different. And the activists out there, John, almost all of them were out there for the Proposition 8 and DOMA cases. They were disappointed. They got an affirmative action ruling, but not the one they were waiting for. I talked to a fellow named Skylar Mays. He's 28. He's about to go into the military on active duty and is very concerned if he chooses to get married, where his marriage will be valid if he's stationed in Maryland or Virginia, and then he goes back home to Arkansas. John, Skylar is sick of waiting. Listen.
It's really ridiculous. It's unfortunate that our court can't come to a general agreement about equal rights for everyone. That's very unfortunate. It seems clearly they're having a struggle deciding on how they're going to rule, or have already been released.
Well, we don't know if they're having a struggle on the Prop 8 and Defense of Marriage Act decision. Certainly they had a struggle on the affirmative action case, which was kicked back to the Fifth Circuit. I guess the question is, next week or even by Thursday, we should know the outcome of this particular case. Is there any sense that the court is moving slow because of some concern among the justices themselves?
Nobody ever really knows, John, why they do this. Now, the court is famous for leaving the biggest decisions till the very end of the session, the bitter end. The same happened with health care. We all remember that. pretty much at the same time of year. So we can't get inside the minds of Justice Roberts and the rest of them about why they're waiting so long. Is it because there's a difficulty in reaching a decision or a balance that they're trying to strike between Prop 8 and DOMA? There's no way to know that. But the court can also add as many days to the session as they choose in order to keep issuing rulings. It would appear now that this Thursday is that day, although we can't even know that for sure. They could bring it as long as they want, but we're expecting, finally, Thursday to have a ruling not only on Proposition 8 from California and the Defense of Marriage Act, but also the remaining voting rights case, which is a big one, John.
Theoretically open-ended, but the best will be saved for last if those two cases do come down on Thursday. Is there any sense, even in Washington, that there is a weariness with the 5-4 narrowness of this court's majority and of the decisions, therefore, that it issues?
If there is a weariness with that, it got placated a little bit today by the broad ruling remanding the affirmative action case back to the court in Texas. So maybe that helped solve that a little bit, John, even though it was not the most major case. I'll tell you the big expectation here in Washington in particular, Proposition 8, of course, and also the Defense of Marriage Act. Why DOMA so much? It's a federal statute that affects the recognition of marriage under federal law, tax law, the IRS and all the rest of it. And of course, as we all know, it is the House Republicans under John Boehner that are parties to the case. They're the one who stepped up to defend the Defense of Marriage Act after the Obama administration reversed itself and refused to defend this law in court. So there are a lot of watchers, not only on the gay rights issue, but also on the effect that it has on the House Republicans, and their stance against gay marriage is sort of the standard bearers of conservatism here in Washington, John.
Talking to us from Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.